Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods Market and Deli. Information at bloomingfoods.coop and goodsforcooks.com. Online at goodsforcooks.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
And I'm Chef Danny Lohr.
Thanksgiving is a couple weeks away, so we're planning our menu in today's podcast. The savory pumpkin side dish is a great way to switch up how you use pumpkins. Food writer Christine Barber talks about her love of sweet potatoes and how she can't imagine a Thanksgiving without them. And Chef Daniel Orr uses the last few green tomatoes from his garden for a fried green tomato recipe that is like nothing you've ever tasted. But first, here's Liz Leslie with a look at this week's news.
It's the end of another week without a new farm bill, but that doesn't mean food news is scarce. Kicking off the week is Hope for Homemade Food in California. The state has some of the most stringent homemade laws. Bake sales aren't even allowed unless they are for charity. Handcrafted advocates are looking for California to join the 30 states who already have homemade laws and help alleviate some of the economic pressure on the state. A University of Washington graduate student has undertaken dumpster diving to make visible how much edible food is simply tossed into the trash. David Giles is forming his thesis around discarded food, which means consuming it himself. Also in Washington, Yakima-based Snowkist growers are under investigation by the FDA after 9 schoolchildren became sick in North Carolina eating the producer's applesauce. Snowkist is no stranger to the FDA. During a June inspection, bags of fruit product were found unsealed and with multicolored mold growing in them. The company repurposed the product into applesauce. It's unclear if any of the repurposed sauce made it to school lunches. Finally, it's never too early to start talking turkey. Thanksgiving is just around the corner, and if you're one of many purchasing a bird, think sustainable. Heritage turkeys reproduce naturally, unlike the large white hybrid varieties often found at the supermarket. And taste tests say they taste better too. Check out your local farmers market for more info, or check the USDA's website for a listing of local markets. You can read more news updates and get the latest in food news on our website, eartheats.org. And be sure to keep an eye on our Twitter feed and on our Facebook page. Just search for Earth Eats. For Earth Eats, I'm Liz Leslie.
The gluten-free diet is one of today's top food trends. That might be a non-issue for wheat, but as Harvest Public Media's Eric Durbin found out, it presents an opportunity for another big Kansas grain.
All-purpose flour isn't so all-purpose for everyone. Gluten is a protein found in barley, rye, and most notably, wheat. And it presents a chronic health challenge for people with celiac disease or a gluten intolerance. It causes bloating, diarrhea, and other far-ranging reactions. While celiac disease is believed to affect one in every 133 Americans, it's been a largely unknown and undiagnosed condition in the U.S., says Mary Schluckeber. That's beginning to change.
Person-to-person contact with people who have celiac disease or some other food allergy has probably brought in more of the ground swelling of information and interest in the diseases.
Schluckeber is the executive director of the Celiacs Brew Association. Her members are helping to build a gluten-free market that is already bringing in more than $2.5 billion a year. And it's quite the irony that the state with the largest collection of celiac's kryptonite is also where they'll find a friend. Kansas is the country's leading producer of sorghum, also known as Milo, which has been coming on in recent years as an alternative for longtime gluten-free staples like potato starch and rice flour. The market, though, isn't a slam dunk for Kansas sorghum farmers. It's close to harvest time on Ben Kramer's Western Kansas farm. As the wind whistles through the crop, he pulls some white grain sorghum kernels off and pops a few into his mouth. They have to be dry enough in order to harvest.
How I check it out is my official moisture tester is put in my mouth and see if it crunches.
With that little crunch, Kramer says he's looking at about a week until he begins harvesting his 450 white sorghum acres. As a heat and drought tolerant crop, sorghum is ideal for the open plains of Kansas and Texas. Kramer has successfully grown red sorghum for animal feed and ethanol, but 3 years ago began converting acres to white sorghum. The white color is more appealing for baking food, plus it brings in more money.
we're projecting, hopefully, to be in that 50 cents to a dollar premium. And that's fairly significant. And so I think taking a couple hours to clean out my equipment once or twice a year is well worth it.
To sell grain that is gluten-free, farmers must take special care to avoid contamination, says Schluckebear with the Celiac Association.
If we can encourage more people to grow the food-grade sorghums and grow them in a way that keeps them contamination-free, I think there is a potentially high market.
Kramer, for one, is full steam ahead. He plans to build grain storage next year to house his food-grade sorghum. That'll keep the crop contaminant-free and give him more control as he looks for potential markets. Still, there's not exactly a groundswell of Kansas farmers turning to food-grade sorghum. Sorghum acres in the state and across the nation are actually down from 2 years ago, and only a small part of that goes to food production. Research chemist Scott Bean is looking to change that with lab and field research aimed at improving sorghum's functionality as a food source.
And a lot of what we know about sorghum proteins, we have sort of assumed from what we know about corn proteins. And we're finding out that some of those assumptions are wrong.
Sorghum flour is dry and crumbly, and it doesn't have any of the natural chewiness found in wheat flour. So currently, sorghum is used as a blend with other gluten-free flours and additives to mimic the properties of all-purpose flours. Bean's team of USDA scientists at the Center for Grain and Animal Health Research in Manhattan, Kansas, is trying to bring more flexibility to sorghum flours, with the big end goal of a fully functional white sorghum flour to replace wheat flour.
Ideally, it'd be targeted for the celiac market so they could produce a little higher quality foods than what you can now. And you can make some pretty good foods from sorghum, but making like a loaf of bread from a cake batter type system is just a lot different than making it from a true dough.
Certainly, there are other grains in the gluten-free hunt as well, amaranth and teff to name a few. These small grains have big markets to fill as they look to provide variety to a growing community of Americans whose only choice is a changing diet. Eric Durbin, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more from the folks at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. We'll do this first recipe in two parts because it's somewhat labor-intensive. Here is a perfect opportunity to recruit some sous chefs in your house to help with the breading of the fried green tomatoes.
Fried green tomatoes. So today we're at the Whistle Stop Cafe. And we're going to do some green tomatoes. It's at the end of the season, what you do is you pick all your tomatoes, even if they're still green, and you can wrap them in newspaper, put them in a box, put them in the root cellar, put them in the coolest, cool, dark place in your house or in the bottom of your refrigerator. And they'll keep for a long time, and there's lots of ways you can do them. You can make green tomato jam. You can make green tomato pickles. But one of the favorites is fried green tomatoes. So that's what we're going to do today. So you have these nice firm green tomatoes, and there's always kind of a core that you need to cut out, kind of like a little cork. Okay, and then we're going to slice them, and I slice a big tomato into 4 or 5 pieces, and I always cut off that little bottom butt of the tomato because the coating won't stick to that, so you want to cut that off. The next step, we're going to do what we call in the business, it's a SBP, which is Standard Breading Procedure. And what that means is that we're going to have flour, which we're going to season, then we're going to have a wet mixture, and then we're going to have the coating. So the flour we're just going to season with some salt and pepper. And I like to be pretty generous with that. So use your fingers to mix it up, and you want to feel, put enough salt in there until you really feel it. Now we're going to do the wet part. And I've got a little bowl here. We're going to crack a couple nice eggs. Okay, we're going to whisk that. And we're going to add a little bit of buttermilk to that. Well, the buttermilk gives it a little bit of a tang to it, and it's also a little richer. Even though there's not fat in it, it's very, very lean to eat. It has a richer mouthfeel. Okay, we're going to add just a little bit of salt and pepper to that, too. So we're seasoning every little step of the way. Okay, and then finally we're going to have our dry mix. Okay, and for that, we've got some of that wonderful cornmeal. Now, I've got that cornmeal right here, and it's really, really high in vitamin K and lots of nutrients. All right, we're going to add some Parmesan cheese. This is a grated Parmesan cheese. We're going to add a little bit of granulated garlic. I'm using granulated garlic because it is a this is a dry coating, so I wouldn't use fresh garlic in this. And then at the end, I'm going to add what I call my Greek garlic seasoning, dried herbs, a little bit of chili flake, and shaved garlic.
When you bread the tomatoes, make one hand your dry hand and the other hand your wet hand to avoid making a royal mess. We'll leave Chef Orr to prep the tomatoes. Time for another seasonal favorite, something that probably makes an appearance in your Thanksgiving meal, sweet potatoes. Sweet potatoes are healthy little suckers. When they're eaten with their skin, they have more fiber than oatmeal, and one medium potato contains 42 times the daily recommendation for vitamin C, all for under 200 calories.
They're just a remarkable vegetable. And if you're going to eat a potato, a sweet potato is just heads and shoulders above a regular white potato.
Christine Barber is the author of the cookbooks Indiana Cooks and Homegrown Indiana, and she's the food editor of Bloom magazine. And boy, does she have a lot to say about sweet potatoes.
They go well with curry. They go well with warm cinnamon kinds of flavors, ginger kinds of flavors. I really like to roast them and then mash them with some orange juice and a little bit of butter.
But she didn't always have this complex of a relationship with sweet potatoes. She was first introduced to them, like many of us are, at Thanksgiving dinner.
You know, everybody has a mom's sweet potato recipe, but my mom's is the best. It was sweet potatoes, boiled and peeled, and then bathed in a caramel of brown sugar with cinnamon and butter. It wouldn't have been Thanksgiving without having those. They were always the signature dish for me, especially because we always put a little bit of salt in it, and it got that salted caramel flavor that now is a big trendy thing, and at the time it was just like, why are you salting dessert?
Why not try this recipe for your Thanksgiving feast this year? Read Christine Barber's recipe on our website, eartheats.org. Alrighty, the tomatoes are ready to be fried, so back to the kitchen we go. Chef Orr will be using the restaurant's fryer for the green tomatoes, but you can fry these at home. He recommends what's called a shallow fry.
You want the fat to go up about a third to two-thirds up the whatever item you're frying, and that would be called a shallow fry. And you can just do that right on the stovetop. The other thing you could do, if you wanted to do a less fattening version, is you could just kind of sprinkle them with olive oil and bake them in a hot oven. And you just want to fry them till they're nice and crisp. And the thing about fried green tomatoes, you know, as opposed to, you know, frying red tomatoes, which are sweeter, these have a nice acidity to them. When you bite into them, they're firmer, so they've got a little bit of a crunch. They're also, there's less liquid in them, so they aren't going to kind of bubble away and pop as much as if you're going to fry a regular tomato. You can see how nicely coated they are. It's a thin coating, though, so it's not like a real heavy breading. You can see the tomatoes right through that coating. And one thing that's important whenever you're frying, when you get them out of the fryer, you want to hit them with some salt and pepper. If you do that while they're still hot from the fryer, the salt will stick better, so it won't just kind of fall off. And that gives us that little saline fix that everybody loves from fried food. Nothing better than salt and grease. All right, and there we go. Now we'll take them up front and put them on a plate. Got some nice goat cheese from Capriol Farms. Arugula pesto we're going to put on top, and then finish it with some of that red pepper sauce around the outside. Maybe a little purple basil leaf to garnish it. And that's my version of fried green tomatoes.
These are great for fried green tomato sandwiches, or serve them for breakfast with fried eggs and bacon. Or do a stack of them with cheese and tomato sauce in between, then bake them, sort of like a Parmesan. If you're a visual person, see step-by-step photos of the process on our website, eartheats.org. And from the homepage, submit your photos of your kitchen creations. Scroll down to the bottom right and click Add Your Photos. We're cooking with pumpkin next, creating a seasonal, savory side dish. But we're not using your typical jack-o'-lantern carving pumpkin. If you've ever tried to cook with a jack-o'-lantern, it's almost like spaghetti squash on the inside. It's very mild and doesn't have a whole lot of flavor. So instead, chef, tell us which varieties of squash work well in the kitchen.
Well, I like the French baking pumpkin, which is kind of a muted green. It's very, very heavy. And one of the ways you can tell a good cooking pumpkin is that it will be very heavy for its size. There are things like the delicata squash. You have a really funny one is this peanut pumpkin, which has these weird-looking peanuts on the outside of it.
Obviously, in addition to the flesh of a pumpkin, you're going to eat the seeds a lot of time, too. And the dish that we're presenting our listeners today uses the seeds in a fun sort of way as a garnish sort of on the end. And, Chef, actually, I've got really great news. You get the day off.
Yeah, we're going to let Chef Bob do this one.
Okay, Bob Atkins. I'm chef de cuisine under Chef Daniel. And today, as he has already alluded to, we are going to slice this big boy up. The recipe that we have calls for a 2-pound French variety. First of all, we got to tackle this beast. I'm going to need a bigger knife for that.
Chef Bob, you're scaring me a little bit with that.
Shouldn't be scared of your knives. So we've got our pumpkin open. What we're going to do is we're going to take out the pith and the seeds here in the middle. Looks like pumpkin murder in here right now. Cut the pumpkin into thin strips, about maybe a quarter inch. Keep them nice and even so they cook evenly. And while I was doing this, I had my big, heavy cast iron pan heating up. So we've got our pumpkin here. We're going to take some nice raw sugar. We're going to take a little au poivre. If you don't have the au poivre, you can use some freshly cracked pepper. Some nice, fresh sea salt all in there. We're going to take a little bit of olive oil. We're going to mix the spices up. And then we're going to use that. It's kind of a thick paste almost. We're going to toss the pumpkin slices with this mixture. All right, so it's coated really nice and evenly. We're going to just place them right into our pan here. We're going to cook these just long enough to caramelize on each side. And because we've only cut them about a quarter inch thick, they won't take more than a couple minutes on each side. All right, so they're pretty much finished here. While I'm getting ready to plate the sautéed pumpkin slices, I'm going to take some of these great green pumpkin seeds. These are grown specifically for the seeds. They're not as fibrous as, say, the seeds you'd get out of a typical jack-o'-lantern. So we're just going to put these into a pan, just keep moving them, and it'll take about 30 seconds, 45 seconds. You can have nice toasted pumpkin seeds to serve with this dish. All right, so we got some nice toasted seeds here. You can really smell that toastiness. It's almost nutty. We're going to take a little bit of extra virgin olive oil and just drizzle over the pumpkin. We're going to take this lemon here and try to catch all the seeds. Just give it a nice drizzle there. And then you get a very nice, healthy alternative to utilizing the pumpkin.
If that dish sounds like something that would work well on your Thanksgiving menu, check out our hour-long Thanksgiving special. We give you tips for preparing the perfect turkey, recipes to satisfy your vegetarian guests, and we'll play some music and tell some stories along the way. Listen and print recipes all at eartheats.org.
Support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods Market and Deli. Information at bloomingfoods.coop.
Production support also comes from goodsforcooks.com. Online at goodsforcooks.com.
Earth Eats is a production of WFIU Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Chef Daniel Orr.
And I'm Annie Corrigan. See you next time.